Okay, let's see. Good morning, and welcome to our September 11th board meeting. And at the moment, I will not present any humor as normal. If I may, I'd like to read one paragraph from my U.S. representative that sent a note last night. Let me just catch my breath here. September 11th, 12 years ago, how quick. I encourage you to reflect. I'll let Terry read it. Last paragraph. Sorry about that.
Today, I encourage you to reflect on the values that matter most to you and to join in the National Day of Service and Remembrance by giving back in your own way. September 11th should be a reminder not only of our loss, but also of our potential.
Perfect. Thank you. And I think it's very important that we all are giving back every day after that horrible day. So we will call for a roll call, please, and we'll get started here. It's kind of you got to bear with me today. It's kind of a rough day for all of us. At the board here, because of September 11th and because of the world slow food movement and heirloom seed exposition in Santa Rosa, I'm running up there as quick as I can. And I mentioned it to great-grandpa yesterday afternoon, and so this is a little humor. And he said, what the hell is this slow food movement? It was only for... when I had a great-grandma, I didn't get the food on the table for me. So he doesn't quite grasp it, but let me tell you, this is a non-corporate event. Boy, we're up there as small farmers, and we're there presenting our products, and there's just thousands of people there, and it's 8 in the morning till 11 at night, let me tell you. So we're going to do it. But and our vice chair is going to handle the situation here as capable as she more than is eligible to do, and I guess I'm able to delegate. Would you help me along, legal team, there quickly?
So the board adopted a resolution in 2004 because it had quorum problems, and the board chair can designate a subcommittee of the board to convene a workshop and hear non-action items, such as the reports here, but it cannot take action, and then the subcommittee must report back to the full board. So if you want to right now delegate or appoint the remaining members once you leave as the subcommittee to convene the workshop to hear the items here that don't require action, that would be good.
Thank you. And it's my privilege to delegate at this time. So thank you for the subcommittee there. And I believe our first item, then we're going to jump around on the agenda, so bear with us, and I apologize for the...
Right,
the,
we should initially board. Do a roll call.
Yeah, we'll do a roll call. Board member Abercrombie is also doing a September 11th ceremony at her city of Mountain View, and she'll be here soon.
Yes.
And hopefully by the time we shift...
We'll do a tag team, but we'll, as you say, we'll have a period when we'll need to have the subcommittee.
Right. Very good. So roll call, please.
Here.
Here.
Board member. Vice Chair Young.
Here.
Chair Muller.
Here. So at this time, we do have some brief introductions, or do you want to handle that later? Is she going to come forward?
So, Anna, do you want to make introduction?
Like Anna Torres to make
staff introduction.
Hi, I'm Anna Torres with Management Services Division, and my new hire is Victor Alion.
Hello.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And as part of introductions, we have the opportunity to present Sustained Superior Accomplishment Award. And I know you have two, and I know Roger Papler is here. Do I see Christine? So let's do Rogers and hold off on Christine.
Okay, so I'll just a little brief background here quickly. Roger oversees sites in the board site cleanup program that have caused soil and groundwater pollution, including most of the complex former federal Supersun sites in Santa Clara County. His productivity has been more than 150 to 200%, and he consistently has had one of the highest cost recovery billing for all staff, so we deeply appreciate that. He's the board liaison on the difficult challenge of state dry cleaner pollution issues. His high productivities are that more site investigation and site cleanup is required and approved, which leads to quicker cleanup of soil and groundwater and a greater quantity of sites cleaned up. So it's with great pleasure, and I believe they even get a little bit of a financial stipend.
Just a little bit. Yes.
Nope. Thanks. And so I was trying to be polite and do the female first, but the wrong guy. So here we go, Roger. Thank you for all your hard work. Next, I don't know if Christine.
With that, I'd recommend we do see if there's anyone for public forum and then go to the pollution prevention.
Right, and we do not have any at this time for public forum, so we'll move on to our next presentation. Today is kind of awards special day here. So we'll welcome.
So this is the 2013 Dr. Tang Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award, and I'd like Dylan Garner to make the staff presentation.
There we go. Okay. Good morning, board members and Chair Mueller. I'm Dylan Garner. I'm an engineer in the NPDES wastewater program. In between wrestling words as a permit writer and corralling dischargers, I'm also the pollution prevention, aka P2, coordinator and vice chair of the Bay Area Pollution Prevention Group. The pollution prevention component of the work I do here at the board is incredibly inspiring. So it is with great pleasure that I MC an award ceremony for such a progressive recipient. This is the seventh year for this award, which we established in memory of Dr. Tae Chung Wu to recognize excellence in pollution prevention. This award honors Dr. Wu's dedication to water quality improvement during his career, and in particular, his leadership in pollution prevention. Pollution prevention involves reducing or eliminating waste and pollutants at their source before they reach the sewer system and have to be removed by treatment. Dr. Wu believed pollution prevention was the necessary next step to water quality improvement after traditional treatment options were fully implemented. This is because advanced treatment would be much more expensive. Each year, we consider suggestions for this award based on leadership, innovation, commitment, measurable results, and benefits to the environment and community. I want to remind everyone that we present the Pollution Prevention Award each year in September to coincide with National Pollution Prevention Week, which is, in fact, next week. Pollution Prevention Week is an opportunity for individuals, businesses, and governments to highlight their pollution prevention and sustainability activities, expand current pollution prevention efforts, and commit to new actions. Presenting this award is our little way of celebrating Pollution Prevention Week. So this year, I'm pleased to announce that the 2013 Dr. Tae Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award goes to the City of Palo Alto. The City of Palo Alto operates a wastewater treatment plant for the East Palo Alto Sanitary District, Los Altos, Los Altos Hills, Mountain View, Palo Alto, and Stanford University. This mid-sized operation has a huge track record as a leader in the research, education, and reduction of emerging pollutants. Contaminants of emerging concern, aka CECs, are chemicals we're becoming more aware of but don't necessarily understand well in terms of their human health and environmental risks. Examples include nitro musks in fragrances, triclosan used in antibacterial soaps, flame retardants in sofas, stain-inhibiting chemicals used on carpets and clothing, and pharmaceuticals, including hormone supplements. Water quality monitoring studies indicate that chemicals from pharmaceuticals, personal care products, pesticides, and other consumer products are being detected more frequently in waterways, including San Francisco Bay. Wastewater treatment plants are not designed to remove CECs, so pollution prevention is a good strategy for reducing these pollutants in the environment before they become big problems. Palo Alto has an outstanding pollution prevention program. We will only begin to scratch the surface with respect to their work today, but please keep in mind these three themes. One, the city has and continues to study CECs to increase everyone's understanding. Two, the city conducts terrific CEC outreach, encouraging the public to reduce the use of CECs. And three, the city maintains a wonderful traditional pollution prevention program with respect to all the more classic pollutants of concern at publicly owned treatment works. Over a decade ago, Palo Alto staff chaired the Emerging Contaminants Workgroup of a local watershed group, which compiled and finalized an endocrine disrupting compounds information sheet and presented at multiple conferences. Palo Alto was also instrumental in the group's production of two white papers, Discussion of Pharmaceutical Disposal to Sewer Systems and Environmental Emergence of Triclosan. The city has partnered with Stanford University, Oregon State University, and the San Francisco Estuary Institute to conduct studies to understand the levels and fates of various CECs in the wastewater treatment process. These efforts led to cutting-edge publications, in some instances authored by city staff, and fact sheets to information to inform region-wide pollution prevention efforts. Palo Alto is currently helping the regional monitoring program with the creation of this year's The Pulse of the Bay, focused on emerging contaminants. The State of the Estuary Conference and the RMP annual meeting in October will focus on emerging contaminants. Beyond engaging in pioneering research, helping understand the levels and fates of various CECs in the wastewater treatment process, Palo Alto gets the message out to the general public via online social media, local newspapers, newsletters, workshops, booths at public events, utility inserts, and programs with school kids. As shown in the images above, taken from local bus ads and utility inserts, Palo Alto has an extensive and award-winning pesticides pollution prevention program. As shown in this slide, Palo Alto targets pet owners and advertising drop-off locations for pet medications for proper disposal. And Palo Alto advertises and hosts monthly household hazardous waste events for a number of household products, such as drain openers, household cleaners, and mercury-containing thermometers, as exhibited on the slide. Palo Alto has also been at the forefront of pollution prevention with respect to reducing triclosan use, a common component in antibacterial soap and many other products. And Palo Alto has been boldly working hard to prevent pharmaceutical pollution. Here's Palo Alto's Karen North promoting No Drugs Down the Drain message at the California Hospice and Palliative Care Association conference last October. But not only is Palo Alto a fierce leader with respect to emerging contaminants, Palo Alto also has a terrific pollution program, pollution prevention and source control track record concerning more traditional pollutants such as trash, fats, oil and grease, and metals such as copper and mercury. For example, Palo Alto has adopted ordinances restricting the use of single-use checkout bags and styrofoam. So with that, I'd like to congratulate the City of Palo Alto and invite Karen North, Environmental Control Programs Manager for the city, to the stage to accept this award from Chair Mueller and pose for a few celebratory pictures. Please note, in the spirit of P2, this gorgeously unique award is made from recycled glass. And Ms. North will then say a few words back here at the podium. Congratulations, City of Palo Alto.
Thank you. Maybe if you give me a quick moment, please. It's kind of special for Palo Alto, the work they've done, and I think they've been getting information about emerging contaminants from Vice Chair Young, because she has been the leader in the Bay Area on that, too, trust me. So you two have been having little secret conversations out there, but it's kind of interesting. We didn't know any better, but it's good news, kind of bad news. So the good news is I was born in Palo Alto on 1146 on Arascadero Road. My dad had a dairy. That's the good news. And he had a cow calf, and I was being born, so they don't know if the vet brought me or the doctor brought me. But I guess the vet's name was Harold. My middle name is Harold, so I don't know. But I guess we were running manure down the Rascadero Creek at that time. But I wasn't on the water board in 46, so I don't know. But let's hope we weren't. But I would imagine we didn't know any better, and now we know better. So thank you for all the hard work you're doing in Palo Alto, and it's very special for me to give this award. And Phil has done a great job over the years in front of this board, and they have definitely set the example for pollution prevention in America, I think. And also Dr. Wu, who this award is named after, in the good old years, many, many years ago, we traveled to Taipei City and presented to their EPA over there pollution prevention and some thinking about how do we move forward with that. And this was a gift they gave me from their country. Excuse me. And he translated for days in the Environmental Protection Agency at EPA. They couldn't grasp a farmer wearing a suit at the time, but that's okay. And we tried to tell them that we have rules, local, state, and federal. And I can just tell you one little example in those days where that, don't worry about rules, old classmate. You know, so hopefully those days are gone now and no more old classmates. And so he did a great job, and I can remember many years ago at our old meeting place, he would always be in the audience there making sure we were doing the right things. And once in a while, he would take a little nap too, but that's all right. We all do that, but Dr. Wu, in his memory, and Wendy was invited today, his wife. And it just was a special trip for all of us, and it was a privilege for me to represent the water board in those days. And I don't know if we get to do those things anymore, but the world has changed. But Palo Alto, congratulations on this amazing award.
As Dylan said, my name is Karen North. I'm with the City of Palo Alto. I've been there for over a decade, and it's really nice for the City of Palo Alto to receive this award and be recognized for all the work we've done on emerging contaminants, because we were one of the forefront, and a lot of agencies are like, why are you looking at emerging contaminants? So it's nice to be recognized. Phil wishes could be here, and I know Phil loves coming in front of the board and telling you all the great things that we do, so I'm going to try and fill his shoes, but he's in Hawaii right now enjoying his time. Just to give you a little bit of information, so as Dylan did a great job on our history in terms of what we've worked on for pollution prevention, kind of Palo Alto's approach to CECs, which you'll notice is actually very similar to what the Pulse of the Estuary, when it comes out, has approach for the Water Board is as well. And then just some real highlights on, you know, we'll do the 50,000 view level because I know you don't have a lot of time. So, you know, really we met we look at the literature being emerging contaminants of emerging concern. We actually had Dr. Theo Colburn come and talk to Palo Alto, and it really brought this issue that we need to look at emerging contaminants. And as public servants, we need to figure out a way of trying to at least limit what's going into the wastewater treatment plant, because our treatment plants are not designed to remove them, and make sure that we're not getting out into the environment and causing potential harm. Because these endocrine disrupting compounds, we don't really have a great way of tracking or knowing what we're doing out into the bay. And so we've always taken the precautionary approach that we should try and handle and look at these emerging contaminants ahead of time and try and find sources and see if we can do reduction. So that's, and we've also, we always try and partner, as Dylan alluded, with other agencies and groups. So we were in the forefront for flame retardants. I'm happy to say PBDEs, the polybromated diphenyl ethers, have been banned and phased out. However, now we're worried. So we had our sludge analyzed for the next flame retardant, and it's in there. And so we need to always be staying ahead of what's the next, pollutant of concern. And so luckily we have San Francisco Estuary Institute that's kind of keeping us abreast of all these as well. But as water board staff and as POTWs, we need to think about what are we looking at next? What's the next contaminant? Triclosan, this is something that we phased out a long time ago. It's an antibacterial agent in hand soaps. It's really hard now if you go to the grocery store to find ones that do not contain it. You can, but you have to look. So we made a procurement policy. We stopped purchasing in 2006, and so did San Jose and other cities, and we're trying to roll it out and get other municipalities to stop buying triclosan-containing hand soaps. And this is something the state could do, because you're a large procurement. If you could send a message that we do not want to have antibacterial hand soaps, then that would actually send a good message out to the manufacturers of those medications, or the hand soaps. We're also working with DTSC, and we're trying to get that one on the first watch list. So for the Green Chemistry Initiative. So there's a lot of things that we are trying to do, because we're only a small agency, so we try and leverage as much as we can. So we get the research, and then we try and make sure the right folks are working on it and partnering. And pharmaceuticals, we've been working on forever, it seems like. We have 5 permanent take-back locations. That's not our ultimate solution. What Alameda County has done and having the manufacturers pay is really the solution. We've collected quite a few, but the wastewater entities and local government have 100 permanent sites, but it shouldn't be taxpayer money paying for the proper disposal of medications. So what we are still working on is educating the medical professionals in training, because hospice caregivers, they're end of life, and they basically have to deem the medications as unrecoverable. And so we're trying to educate them now that there's other solutions, that we have these take-back collections, and for the controlled substances that they need to deem unrecoverable, find other solutions like putting into an adult diaper, or other solutions are available for them. So we've been working and training the hospice throughout the Bay Area. So that was a Palo Alto-led program, but now everything that we do, we look at Bay Area Pollution Prevention Group. So we try and pilot it and then roll it out region-wide, or we just go straight to region-wide. And then the other thing for pharmaceuticals is there's, as I alluded to earlier, there's a Senate Bill 727. And if you can, Dylan's in the past has already sent a support letter, but do another support letter, because it's now a 2-year bill, or will be. But we're trying to partner with California Product Stewardship Council to make manufacturers pay for the disposal of pharmaceutical waste and make it so every resident can have an easy solution. So they're taking Alameda County's ordinance, and they're trying to make it statewide. The pharmaceutical industry is really powerful, so we need to make sure that we come together and come up with the right data, give them the message that we don't want it down the sanitary sewer, and also partner with our waste friends, because we also don't want it to go into solid waste as well. So I really strongly support you guys to California Product Stewardship Council if you're not already a member, and then the Product Stewardship Institute, which is the national organization. And so the Water Board, how we can partner together for CECs in the future, because this is a contaminant that's not your traditional contaminant where you can find the source and handle it. This is actually going to be a lot of regulatory, working with the federal agencies, putting in letters, trying to see if the Green Chemistry Initiative can help to reduce the CECs entering the wastewater treatment plants, because as you know, our treatment plants are not designed to remove them. And so the best thing is if we can try and reduce it at the source, which is the true message of pollution prevention. And obviously there are the Tom Mumley and Naomi, and there's others as well on the Water Board that are part of the Emerging Contaminants Work Group, so we're trying to stay ahead of the next pollutants that are coming down. But we really appreciate all your help and support, because we're one agency, but you have a much bigger stick in terms of when you try and write comment letters and get basically regulatory changes on some of these contaminants of emerging concern. So we really appreciate the opportunity to come here, but view this as a door opening. We appreciate the award. I worked with Dr. Wu when I first started. He's a magnificent man, and we just look forward to partnering in the future. So thank you very much.
And if I may be excused, I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will reconvene as a workshop now.
We'll reconvene as, convene is the appropriate method.
Convene as a workshop.
Continue as a workshop. Subcommittee of the board. So as we continue to work through the agenda, I recommend that we do the sustained interior accomplishments award for Christine Ocean.
Yes. So, welcome, Christine.
I'm so sorry I'm late for this honor. Thank you so much, everybody.
Well, I'm delighted because that means that we get to take a deep breath and enjoy giving you this award. It's really an honor, you know, for us and the board to be able to recognize you folks who've done so much good work. Christine is a section leader in the board's Watershed Management Division, and she has, from what we can tell, sort of not only built a really outstanding team, but revolutionized a lot of our procedures so that they become way more efficient. She has developed their structure, the section structure, for overseeing the industrial and construction stormwater general permit programs. We heard last month about how successful all several thousand permits were, except for one. But that was a big improvement because we used to have except for a lot. So she has developed and used templates and form letters to just get the work done faster, more efficiently, developing the early settlement offers, which really streamlined things from our perspective. And, you know, since we are working with fewer staff now than we did a decade or so ago, it's really important to be able to do the work that we do faster and quicker, but still just as effectively, and because the bottom line is what happens out in the environment. Christine also has provided statewide leadership as part of the State Board's Stormwater Program Roundtable, and again, initiating efforts to make what we have to do happen faster and more effectively. She's also led team efforts within the board across different parts of this board to assess complex sites and make sure that they neither have to talk to multiple people nor get lost through the cracks, and that's always a great challenge. So, Christine, we're delighted to be able to present this to you today.
Thank you so much.
Anna, can we do another introduction?
We have one more staff introduction.
Again, I'm Anna Torres, and this is Lewis Ruffin. He's in my Management Services Division. He's our new Angela since Bruce stole my current Angela. Thank you.
Welcome to the board. All right, since we are juggling the order of things, for those of you in the audience, we're juggling the order of things because we are convened as a workshop now. I believe what we're going to do now is the board members and officers' reports.
Right, and to kick that off, I'd suggest asking Tam Dodek if she'd like to
say a few words.
Yes. Welcome. We really appreciate you schlepping all the way down here for our board meetings.
Are you kidding? It's always a pleasure. I love the Bay Area and the weather here. And the chance to escape from Sacramento in the last week of the legislative session. Hey, life couldn't get any better. No, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to update you on a couple of things. The legislative session is wrapping up in Sacramento, and there are a lot of things happening, some bills that we were watching, and straight some bills that we continue to watch, but just of interest to you, I think, are two particular bills, one having to do with moving the drinking water program from the Department of Public Health over to the Water Board. That bill has stalled in Senate Appropriations and is not expected to move. However, Assemblymember Pereira has gutted and amended another bill, AB 1393, which now proposes moving only the drinking water SRF program over to the State Water Board. We'll see how that goes. Another bill that seemed to have stalled in Senate Appropriations, which is somewhat of a concern, at least for me anyway, since I've been following the underground storage tank cleanup fund program quite extensively. This is the bill AB 282, which would have sunset the fund, which is currently scheduled to expire at the end of 2015, if I remember my dates correctly. And also, there was a 0.6 cents fee that was supposed to end at the end of this year that we were hoping to, or at least some of us were hoping to get extended for another 2 years. So that bill looks like it's also has been stalled and is not likely to move ahead. Other bills that we're tracking that, you know, we'll have no idea what the ultimate outcomes would be, but obviously fracking Senator Steinberg's CEQA reform bills, which has some provisions in there that we're interested in. And also, particular with respect to your regional water board, and I know Bruce has taken a great deal of interest in this bill, AB 1200, which would authorize the regional water board to authorize a pilot project with Sonoma County Water Agency to store recycled water in ag irrigation ponds. That bill seems to still be in play as well, and which we are also tracking. So lots of things are happening this week. I wanted to also let you know that at the last state board meeting, we did have an organizational discussion amongst the board members regarding priorities for 2013 and 14. As you know, a few years ago, we started identifying a few priorities each year and directing our executive director, Tom Howard, to put together a time schedule and authorizing him to the extent he can to move resources around to ensure that these board priorities get completed as soon as possible. And, it's been an interesting experiment, and we're at the point now where we actually are seeing the completion of our 2010, 2011, 2012 designated priorities, or at least they're in progress. And so now we're starting to look at the next set of priorities. And just so you know, the remaining ones are like the industrial general stormwater permits, things that, you know, desalination policy, things that are, you know, have been on way for quite a while. And so we haven't quite wrapped up the discussion, but we did come to some agreements. And I mentioned at my last report the idea of a stormwater strategic work plan that has been elevated and identified as a board priority. And something that your assistant executive officer is very interested in, that we've been working on for quite a while, too many years to count, right, Diane? The wetlands policy has now been designated a board priority. Knock on wood, that means it will be on its way pretty soon. And then finally, something else that is just starting to kick off is looking at our anti-degradation policy, Resolution 6816, which was adopted in 1968, and asking the question, is there a need to update that policy? Is there a need to provide some guidelines? Questions regarding its application both to surface water and groundwater. A few years ago, staff did initiate a scoping effort, and so the ideas that were received as part of that scoping effort, along with some recent, I think, court decision, have nudged into reexamining this at a much more focused, a much more higher level effort. And so that, looking at the anti-degradation policy, looking at a potential update or development of guidelines, has been also identified as a board priority. And the state board staff is starting some initial focus meetings with various stakeholders this month and next month to try to just get a plan of what are the issues out there involving the anti-degradation policy and what's the best way for us to go forward on this. I expect this will be a major effort, not only for the state board, but also the regional board staff and for our stakeholders for the next few years. But again, I think the timing is right, that there are some aspects of the policy that we do need to revisit. Some because based on our experience, and others simply because of recent, like I said, court decisions that I think have pushed us into that direction.
Questions? Thank you.
So I look forward to updating you on those new priorities, especially the anti-degradation one. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, we'll continue with the rest of the board member reports. Jim, would you like to go ahead?
I have two items. First of all, I wanted to start with a shout out for John Mueller. Not everyone knows what John goes through to get here in the morning and come across from Half Moon Bay. And with a commitment to Santa Rosa, he also recognized his commitment to pollution prevention and got here for it. And I think that's a remarkable statement of priorities, that we are not just a regulatory board, but we're also trying to provide and recognize leadership in those things which change behavior outside of the regulatory realm and do it cooperatively. And I think that's remarkable. I think I would be remiss to not mention Phil Bobel. Phil and Terry and I all worked together at EPA back when we were young pups and we would have good ideas. And management at EPA would say, that's a great idea, get the state to do it. So here we are. and at the state often they said, get the local government to do it. So, Phil and Terry and I are all taking that advice. And it is kind of the seeding. But the recognition of pollution prevention and proper management, I just wanted to give a shout out to. The other thing, to tie into Tam's comments, and setting priorities, this board has been working on that. About a year and a half ago, I started interviewing people about what they thought the board's priorities should be, what we were doing well. And I got a lot of great input, including from Tam. And the clear interest among all the stakeholders was to have us eventually set priorities in a public setting. So we've now gone through that and gone through a discussion as part of the annual or semi-annual or at least several times a decade executive director evaluation. We've had that internal discussion around what our budgetary constraints are, what we all think as board members should be priorities if we can make them so, and what flexibility we might have. Of course, to adopt any such program, we need to do it in public and in a transparent manner. So we've had that preliminary discussion, and it is going to be scheduled for the workshop in November. So it is an effort to try to show you what our priorities are, what we think perhaps should be higher priorities, but lack the resources to do so. so we can try to address the most important issues with the greatest number of resources within our constraints. So those are the two I wanted to mention.
Michelle.
So I don't have really much to report. It was a busy month for me work-wise, so didn't get too much of the, you know, didn't have many meetings regarding the board or did a lot of reading. Actually, we just put together a proposal to send to NSF, and I think maybe a couple of years ago I would never add this to it, but this year I made sure that I have a paragraph in there that says we have to consider the impacts of water quality on water scarcity. So, and I like elaborated a lot on it. So I think that's being part of this board and, you know, dealing with all the issues, it makes me more think about how everything that we do can impact our resources in different ways. So so I guess that's
we have a convert.
I think we had the meeting regarding reviewing Bruce's performance, which was definitely a great sort of window for me to learn more about all the efforts that all the board members have been making and all the work that Bruce obviously is doing, which is amazing, and also all the staff members that support you. So that was also a very, very informative meeting for me. With that, I let you.
All right. Well, thank you. I was able to sit in this month on the chair's call. John was loading and unloading trucks and doing what he does, as Jim pointed out. I don't know. Even when he works 24 hours a day, I don't know how he does the whole thing. So I was really delighted to be able to help him out with this one thing. The bulk of the chair's call was spent talking about the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting agenda. And there were no big changes from the agenda that we have seen before, although there was a little bit of extra information about what is going to be happening in the pre-meeting on Wednesday. So we were, here it is. At this point in time, this seems to be a changing target.
Evolving.
Evolving, exactly. At this point in time, the idea is that we can come anytime from noon on and check in at the EPA building. There will then be we can then go as a group over to the state capitol to begin the meetings at the state capitol at 1:30. But it's also possible to just join the group at the state capitol at 1:30. The next time that's convenient, if you want to join the group, would be back at Cal EPA at 3:00, which is when we're then going to be meeting with the other representatives of the other agencies. So hopefully that will help everyone with planning on when and where to go. The remainder of the chair's call was reports from different regions, and I'll spare you all the details on that. I think that we'll get most of that information at the WQCC meeting. That's it.
Just a couple things to note. In this month's report, there's items on the control of an oily seep from the landfill at Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. That ties into the status report you'll be hearing shortly about the Department of Defense program. And likewise, although it's not, it was initiated under a different enforcement scheme, the report on the progress being made on the removal of the vessels from the Sassoon Bay Reserve Fleet, or the Mothball Fleet, I think it really actually exceeds our expectations when we went through the enforcement over the Maritime Administration, that finally, the Maritime Administration got the message on that and has been very diligent in their efforts to not only comply with the consent decree, but be ahead of schedule. And so we're pleased to see that, and I think that will be part of the report you'll hear. I also wanted to highlight the event I attended on August 30th, the recognition of the completion of the recycled water pipeline for the Napa-Sonoma salt marsh restoration project. And that's significant in that here is an example of the reuse of recycled water for essentially a new use, not just while there will be some agricultural reuse, but here it will be used to dilute the bittern in the ponds, which is a challenge for restoring those ponds. And while the process will take up to 10 years, this is a significant and a beneficial mechanism of reuse that's going to have multiple benefits for all. So there was a lot of people taking credit, but I think this agency certainly can take a lot of credit for our ability to move through a number of permits and to direct traffic on the overall program. And actually, since there was an article on this in the San Jose Mercury, the public affairs people up at the State Board are interested to turn this whole effort into a fact sheet on all of our work on salt pond restoration. So we'll work with them on publicizing that. So we'll keep you posted on that. I'd also like to call out Keith Licton's participation in the low-impact development symposium. Keith's been active in this for many years and has been a leader not only within the region, but essentially nationwide in promoting low-impact development. And so it's always an opportunity when in those limited instances when we do have the opportunity to travel to both learn things but share what we've learned. And I think Keith's done a great job of sort of doing it both ways, both sharing what we've been doing in the Bay Area but also bringing good ideas to us that show that if it can be done elsewhere around the country or to a certain degree around the world, things like that should be done here in the Bay Area. So continue to track that.
I did notice that it was an international symposium, and it's really wonderful that we can have a leadership role in that. Can you give us a short list of some of the other countries that are really leading the charge on this?
I'd have to defer to Keith to that, so we can get a little further report maybe from him.
We'll do it at a later date.
Yeah.
Thank you.
With that, I'd recommend to continue in as workshop mode to hear our status report on the Department of Defense program from staff at this point. So I'd like to call on Alec Nagel and David Elias to make the presentation.
Dim the lights a little bit. Well, good morning, Vice Chair Young and members of the board. My name is Alec Nagel. I'm a section leader in the Groundwater Protection Division. Today, David Elias and I want to present to you our cleanup program for the Department of Defense and Department of Energy facilities in our region. Throughout this presentation, I'm going to use the terms defense and energy as shorthand for U.S. Department of Defense and U.S. Department of Energy. Our program uniquely deals with cleanups at active and mainly closed military bases, active energy facilities, and occasionally other federally owned facilities, as Bruce mentioned, the Suisun Bay Reserve Fleet, for example. I'll begin the presentation with a programmatic overview and some major accomplishments since we last presented this to you in 2010, and then David will follow with specific highlights from cleanup projects that the program staff are working on or have been working on. First, I'd like to give you some background about the types and locations of the defense and energy facilities in our region. Currently, there are 36 defense facilities and 4 energy laboratories in our region, as shown on this map. The Navy facilities are shown in blue. The red is for Army. The orange is for the Air Force, and yellow signifies the energy laboratories. The tan color is a category called formerly used defense sites. No jokes, please. FUDs for short. FUDs are facilities that were once owned, operated, or leased by any branch of the military, and typical uses included missile silos, gun batteries, or radar stations, among other things. The light blue rectangular area down there, let's see, right there, is the Suisun Bay Reserve Fleet, which is the Maritime Administration's, owned by the Maritime Administration. And David will talk more about that later. It's often referred to as the Mothball Fleet or the Ghost Fleet. One point I want to make about defense and energy facilities is that many of them are located along the historic Baylands, which you can see is the green area that rings the San Francisco, San Pablo, and Suisun Bays. And that's going to have more significance later when I talk a little bit about groundwater cleanups along the bay margin and wetlands restoration projects. Some of the Navy facilities you may be familiar with include the shipyards at Mare Island and Hunter's Point, shown here, the naval stations in Alameda and Moffett Field in the South Bay, and other naval stations at Treasure Island, the Skaggs Island up in the North Bay, and the Concord Naval Weapons Station. Some of the Army facilities that you may be familiar with include the Presidio of San Francisco, the Oakland Army Base, and the Hamilton Army Airfield in Novato. The Military Ocean Terminal in Concord and the Reserve Forces training area at Camp Parks in Dublin are examples of 2 active military army bases in our region. In the North Bay, the Travis Air Force Base is also remaining fully active. The 4 energy laboratories include the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in the Berkeley Hills, the Lawrence Livermore and Sandia National Laboratories in Livermore, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in the hills above the Stanford campus. One of the main points I'd like to make is that it's the concept that defense and energy facilities are like small industrial cities. That's because many of them are large and complex, and they have a range of pollution sources. As a result, they overlap with many of our regulatory programs. This table summarizes the different types of defense and energy facilities in our program. The third column shows the number of individual cleanup sites. So if the base or the lab is like a small city, then the individual cleanup sites are like the gasoline stations, the dry cleaners, the landfills, etc., within that facility. In all, there are 330 cleanup sites associated with the 40 defense and energy facilities in our region. The last column in this table shows the federal dollars that support 10 staff and 2 students. And these federal funds are made available through a cost recovery grant for the cleanup oversight. The one exception here to the federal funding rule is that the 4 facilities shown in the purple row here, this land was former military base land that had been transferred back to a city or other civilian entity for reuse and redevelopment.
That staffing budget is in regional board staff, correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And at these transferred or privatized facilities, we now look to the new owner, which is often the city or the city's developer, to continue the cleanup under a separate private cost recovery agreement and typically a cleanup order that is adopted. So some of the examples, the four examples are the Presidio of San Francisco, fully transferred and privatized, Point Malate Naval Fuel Depot in Richmond, which was transferred in recent years, the Oakland Army Base, and parts of large parts of Mare Island. So over the years, we've developed six programmatic priorities consistent with the Water Board's mission and also as a guide to help staff deal with these multifaceted projects. The first priority is controlling groundwater plumes that discharge to surface water or that threaten beneficial uses in any way. As I mentioned, this is important because many of the defense facilities have had spills and leaks in close proximity to the bay margin. And I also want to point out that we estimate that there are about 40 groundwater plumes currently along the bay margin that are going through cleanup and that could threaten or have threatened surface water. These are typically our highest priorities. The second priority is restoring impacted wetlands and other habitat areas. We estimate that several hundred acres of historic wetlands have been affected by pollution due to defense-related activities. The third priority is cleaning up soil and groundwater pollution to appropriate reuse standards, such as commercial, industrial, recreational, or residential. All of these are viable. Reuse is typically negotiated between the Department of Defense and the city or the city's developer. The fourth priority is approving what we call records of decisions, or RODs for short, that memorialize the cleanup plan. The ROD is a legally enforceable document. The fifth priority is issuing cleanup orders or other directives to the new owner after the land is transferred for civilian reuse. This helps ensure that cleanup under the new ownership occurs in a timely manner and is protective of human health and the environment. The sixth and final priority is closing sites in a timely manner. And speaking of closed sites, in 2008, the State Board asked us to develop appropriate annual performance measures for all our programs. And in response, we set a programmatic goal of 40 site closures per year. In the most recent year, ending June 30th, we exceeded that with 44 closures. And then in the period since 1999, when we first began using the state's GeoTracker database to track the status of sites, we've closed 630 sites, about an average of 45 per year. So it's, you know, definitely exceeding our goals. There are currently about 170 groundwater plumes at all our defense and energy facilities. I mentioned 40 of those are in the close to the bay margin threatening surface water. 75% of all of these plumes are currently controlled and are undergoing some form of remediation. The act of remediation here generally refers to engineered cleanup technologies that, that destroy contaminants in place or through excavation. We count that as an active step. Passive remediation, however, refers to the concept of monitoring the natural but often slower degradation of contaminants in, as they occur in the ground without any addition of chemical oxidants or other other pushes to clean it up. As such, passive remedies do require longer-term monitoring to watch this process happen naturally. The majority of the plumes are chlorinated solvents or petroleum. The most common chlorinated solvent, of course, is the dry cleaning fluids or metals parts degreasers. The most common petroleum that we see here at these defense sites is gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel fuel. Currently, none of the plumes threaten drinking water resources. At the same time, we are vigorously pursuing those that do threaten surface water sources along the bay margin. And as I mentioned, any threats to beneficial use would be our highest priorities. About 650 wetland acres have been restored or are currently being restored at former defense facilities. Shown here is the 600-acre Hamilton Army Airfield, where nearly 5 million cubic yards of dredge sediment from the Port of Oakland has currently been placed. This was done pursuant to waste discharge requirements that you adopted in 2005 with Board Member McGrath's enthusiastic support. The levee breach is anticipated this winter. In the next few years, wetlands restoration is also planned at the 270-acre Hamilton North Antenna Field, shown just above this Army Airfield in this photo, as well as at Alameda Point, Hunter's Point, and the Army's Military Ocean Terminal in Concord. The largest restoration is planned at the former Skaggs Island Naval Security Post, which is located in the northern edge of San Pablo Bay, as shown here in blue. In 2011, about 3,300 acres at Skaggs Island were transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for inclusion in the San Pablo Bay National Wildlife Refuge, which is shown here in red. All told, that's over 4,000 acres of wetlands restoration at former defense facilities in our region. There are 43 landfills at defense and energy facilities region-wide, and that's about one landfill for each. These are in addition to the 56 closed municipal landfills that board staff, Keith Roberson discussed in his land disposal program presentation to you last month. None of the landfills are currently being used, and most have been inactive since the 1970s. The accomplishment here is that all of them have now gone through either final or interim closure, regulatory closure process, which includes protective covers or caps that promote lateral drainage and runoff, as well as collection systems for leachate and landfill gas as necessary. The closed landfill shown here is, again, at the Hamilton Army Airfield in Novato. The final accomplishment that I want to discuss is about defense land that has been transferred for civilian reuse or ecological habitat. The safe reuse of former defense land is a major goal of the military as well as all of the agencies involved. In most cases, once defense land is cleaned up, it's transferred to a local city for redevelopment or to a state or federal agency for habitat restoration or preservation. In some cases, defense land is transferred to other branches of the military, or it's not transferred at all if it's continuing to be an active facility. The slide shows that there are 42,000 acres of land at defense facilities in our region. Currently, about 22,000 of those acres have been transferred for some form of reuse. In the next few years, the Department of Defense plans to transfer another 8,000 of those acres, 5,000 of which will occur at the Concord Naval Weapons Station to the city of Concord. So that's a biggie coming up. Table 2 in your program report gives specific summary and details of actual transfers that have occurred plus the near future plans. I think it's important also to mention at this time that, let me emphasize one thing, that the land transfer for civilian reuse is a deal between the military and the city. Our role in this is, with other state and federal agencies, is to make sure that the land is cleaned up to the protective standards based on that reuse that is negotiated between those entities, and also to protect water quality. I think it's important also to mention that cleanup and redevelopment of defense land, particularly those facilities along the bay margin, do consider the implications of sea level rise. This has been something that has been discussed quite frequently at these meetings. For example, at the Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard, the Navy is designing engineered revetments and seawalls as part of the cleanup so that it will facilitate the transfer back to the city and then can be redeveloped. And these, the revetments, seawalls, and other even shoreline habitat that is restored is going to be also done in a way that's protective to contain and landfill waste that may be there as well. So protecting not only for reuse and redevelopment, but protecting the remedies of any waste that has to be contained in perpetuity. So this is critical, not only for that redevelopment, but also to maintain the integrity of these remedies. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to David Elias, who can talk about specific project highlights.
Thank you, Alec. Good morning, Vice Chair Young and board members. I'll now present a number of interesting projects that we've been working on, starting with the Alameda Point Naval Air Station, located on the island of Alameda. We selected this project to highlight due to its large scope. This year, the Navy broke ground on a 110-acre landfill closure and wetlands enhancement project at an area located on the southwestern tip of Alameda Island. As the lead state permitting agency for wetland preservation and creation, Water Board staff played a significant role in bringing this project to fruition. On the left of this photo is the former landfill that is being regraded and capped. On the right, you can see an existing wetland with pickleweed that was preserved during this large construction project. To give you an idea of the size of the project, the scraper in the background in the upper left is about 12 feet tall and 35 feet long. The project is so large you can barely see it. The final disposition of the project will be open space that will provide high-quality wetland habitat. This photo shows an area where the Navy entered a tidally connected wetland, regraded, and constructed a waterfowl refuge island. The project is still active, and we are working with the Navy to manage stormwater issues through the winter.
Where did the sediment for the capping come from on that project?
Seaplane Lagoon, lot of it.
So they dredged it out of Seaplane Lagoon, they found clean areas in there?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, separated it. And I'll talk more about that. Moving north to Sassoon and San Pablo Bay, I will now discuss the Sassoon Bay Reserve Fleet and Mare Island Dry Docks. We highlighted these two projects due to a remarkable timing coincidence that linked them together. As we presented in the September Executive Officer's Report, the Maritime Administration conceded to a consent decree in 2010 that required a strict schedule for the removal and recycling of these vessels. The expedited recycling of the Sassoon Bay Reserve Fleet due to the consent decree provided an opportunity for the refurbishing and reopening of the World War II-era dry docks at Mare Island in Vallejo, about 10 miles away. The dry docks were reopened in 2011 and have participated in the breaking and recycling of the Sassoon Bay Reserve Fleet. Water Board staff played a significant role in the evaluation and permitting of a large dredging operation that was needed to open the dry dock gates. And we issued an MPDS permit for the discharges associated with the filling and evacuating of the dry docks. This photo is of the first vessel to be recycled at the dry dock, the Solon Termin. And this is what the vessel looked like a few weeks later, with only about one-third of the ship left after cutting the ship up and recycling the steel. For this next project, we're moving south to Alameda and Treasure Islands. We decided to present these two projects, Seaplane Lagoon at Alameda Point and Clipper Cove at Treasure Island, also due to coincidental beneficial timing. This year, the Navy completed a monumental sediment cleanup project at Seaplane Lagoon in Alameda. This is a photo of the clamshell bucket used to dredge the lagoon. The project included the dredging and processing of 137,000 cubic yards of sediment, which resulted in the restoration of 10 acres within Seaplane Lagoon. A number of caseworkers have worked on this large project, as it took many years to plan and complete, especially with the special care that was needed to manage the radiological risk associated with the removed sediment. This photo is of the drying beds that were used to process the dredged sediment at Alameda Point. This case study is also an example of the Navy cleanup team working together to avoid reinventing the wheel. As we speak, the Navy is dredging lead shot impacted sediment from Clipper Cove on Treasure Island. Rather than constructing a processing facility at Treasure Island, the Navy is barging the Treg sediments across the bay to Alameda Point and reusing these drying beds prior to them being dismantled. And once the sediments are screened and processed, they will likely be used as foundation materials for the closure of a landfill, a different landfill at Alameda Point, thus avoiding trucking and disposal at a distant open landfill. There's two landfills we're working on, if that wasn't clear. This next project I will present is located at the Military Ocean Terminal in Concord, or in short, at MOTCO. MOTCO is still an active munitions depot. It is currently operated by the Army and is also located on Sassoon Bay. MOTCO was originally run by the Navy and was associated with the Concord Naval Weapons Air Station. In 1944, a 4,600-ton munitions explosion at the terminal destroyed the adjacent small town of Port Chicago, killing 390 people and scattering unexploded ordnance and metal debris into Sassoon Bay. This photo was taken after the explosion, and you can see in the lower left of the photo the remaining pilings from the former wharf. Last month, under waterboard staff oversight, the Army embarked on an impressive effort to locate and remove from Sassoon Bay all the unexploded ordnance associated with the 1944 explosion using a high-tech barge, crane, and high-powered magnet. This photo is of a helicopter completing an airborne magnetometer survey to locate the unexploded ordnance. The survey information was used to accurately locate the potential ordnance both on land and in Sassoon Bay. This photo shows the barge-mounted crane and magnet that are being used today to recover the potential ordnance. Located in San Francisco, Hunters Point Shipyard is one of the sites that represents the gamut of the type of subsurface investigation and remediation projects we oversee. This is an historic photo of the shipyard at its busiest. In this case, we have signed 6 records of decision since 2009, documenting the cleanup approach for most of the 936-acre former shipyard. This work included closing over 40 petroleum sites to help pave the way for transfer of about 90 acres to the City of San Francisco, which will begin in 2015. This is a before photo of one of the former dry docks that is non-operational and flooded. Excavation, soil vapor extraction, and groundwater treatment have been completed in the vicinity of this area. And this is an after-development artist rendition of the planned redevelopment in this area. As you can see, the dry dock will be converted into a wharf, and the surrounding upland areas will be converted to a mixed-use residential and commercial development. The city's plans for reuse also include open space, mixed commercial and residential, research and development, and educational, cultural. And these are the folks responsible for everything we presented today. As Alec mentioned at the beginning of his talk, our sites are like small industrial cities. Therefore, we are required to be proficient in all of the regulatory tools available to this agency. Our caseworkers are cross-trained, extremely experienced, creative, and flexible. In our division, we have a fantastic mix of engineering geologists, hydrogeologists, biologists, chemists, and civil and chemical engineers. In closing, Alec and I would like to express how lucky we are to work with such a great group of people. This concludes our update on the DoD program, and we are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Wells whiz?
She'll copy that.
I had not a question but a comment. I really appreciate you mentioning about the sea level rise component in the planning for containment systems and capping. And since sea level rise is in all of our minds all the time, it's really nice that you were able to make explicit that we are making sure that these sites are engineered to account for sea level rise. And if you can just keep reminding us of that every time you present something, we'll appreciate it.
Can you use this one, Alan?
Yeah. That's definitely something that sort of has been happening during the negotiation of the cleanups. The first question is, well, what happens when it rises 3 feet? Is this landfill still going to be, you know, washed away or whatever? So I think staff have been working on it for a long time, and now it's kind of really front and center. And so it's kind of a fun, interesting topic.
Good. We appreciate that.
I also had a comment. I mean, it's nice to see progress on all of these in terms of making reuse of sediment, particularly dredge sediment, work. I just wanted to point out some of the logistical difficulties. When I was working at the Port of Oakland and we started planning for the 50-foot project in about 1997 or 98, I can't remember exactly, we went to talk to both the Navy and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because we had a bunch of sediment right across the estuary from them, and we were certainly willing to place it to cap landfills or cap seaplane lagoon. But particularly in seaplane lagoon, the need to characterize that sediment and isolate what was truly contaminated enough to either be removed or capped was a substantial body of work. So the timing of that project, the Port of Oakland 50-foot project, didn't work at all with remediation efforts over there, and barely worked with Hamilton. I remember I was vilified when I said that was a possibility, but you know, no good deed goes unpunished. So it ends up being logistics in tying projects together, and I'm glad to see the work that was done, and glad to see that Seaplane Lagoon was not as contaminated as we feared.
They had to. Some of the sediment had to be taken away.
General question, I'm not sure this is what we deal with or not, but I was wondering, this beachfront areas that are created, or the you know, waterfront areas that are created, are like, there are signs for people to know these are landfill. I'm just wondering, what's the water quality of that water around these areas? Are they, is anybody monitoring them, or like are they usable as a, you know,
the surface water adjacent to a with the water quality should be equal to what you would find anywhere in the bay. That's our goal.
Okay, so there is a monitoring.
Oh yeah, yeah. These on. Yeah, okay. And the cleanup, the upland cleanup is thorough and very, and we consider the protection of surface water.
Okay. Actually, there's a real time surface water monitoring program, or very close to real time. There's a requirement to monitor quality at beaches, and the State Water Resources Control Board staff that work on the website make that availability almost in real time. So the end users, the kayakers, the stand-up paddlers, the windsurfers, they have access to recent spills in very close to a real time. And it's really actually spills from upstream overflows that are the biggest problem, at least in my experience.
Yeah, and you know, to your point, I have used that system, but whenever we want to go anywhere, you know, taking the kids to the beach or anything. But I was just wondering, you know, I was in Alameda one time, and the beachfront, it's very, the water is very bubbly. It makes you wonder if it's how clean it is, you know. And
you mean the foam?
There's a foam in the water that comes in. So I wasn't sure if these are these areas. I mean, are actively monitored the same way that we are monitoring like other beachfront areas, or are there any other precaution that
I know that beach is monitored actively by East Bay Regional Park District for swimming safety.
Okay. Thank you.
Bruce, this might be an opportunity. I think I could do it, but I'd rather ask you to do it, to remind us that what we did in the basin plan last time around. We had a long discussion as to whether everything in the Bay Shore should be Rec 1 and Rec 2 in terms of the beneficial uses. And if you can just remind us of that.
Right.
I think I remember, but...
2 points, and this cycles back to Nusha's point about the safety, that we have identified essentially all of the bay as existing for what we call Rec 1, recreational use, swimming, kayaking, windsurfing. And there we are trying to be essentially protective of that human health goal, largely driven in that case by bacteria. But our overall goal for land disposal facilities, such as the Department of Defense facilities and any of the municipal landfills, is to ensure that we have full containment of that waste. And that's where it's key that we continue to weigh in on the need to maintain that containment during all potential sea level rise issues and the same. Now, one issue in terms of the Rec 1 use we have had is that we are fully supportive and, in fact, doing a lot of work on wetland restoration. Historically, wetlands have been sort of lumped into that Rec 1 use. But, and this also ties into the reuse of cleaned and treated wastewater, we don't necessarily want people swimming or sailboarding, et cetera, in the middle of the wetlands. And so we have had an instance in the Hayward Marsh where we have had recycled water reintroduced into the marsh, where we have reclassed that from the Rec 1 use to our Rec 2 use, which is more human exposure but not direct contact. In other words, hiking, walking, visual benefit. And so that's going to be a challenge moving forward as we have more projects that, such as in the North Bay, where we do want to use recycled wastewater to make sure we have the right classification and the right protection for bacteria and other constituents.
And do we sort of put signs that let people know these are Rec 1 and Rec 2, or people are they're responsible to go and find this themselves?
Well, in the area, for instance, in the Hayward Marsh, that area is managed by East Bay Regional Park District, and it actually is fenced off,
okay. And
there are signs saying that recycled water is used there. Partially, though, the idea to fence it off is that there's habitat, and it's turned into a very spectacular lease turn rookery there. So we're trying to keep people out of that habitat. But that's going to be a challenge, as I say, moving forward as we look for how do we come up with a balance of reuse and public access and human exposure.
So. And you know, not to iterate what I just said earlier, but one of the reasons I asked that question, I knew that we are monitoring, but I was wondering if we monitor for the certain things that we do find in these sort of reclaimed land, like the radioactive material and all that. I don't know.
Well,
those are specifically monitored separately? Or
if we're overseeing a facility that's either an ongoing land disposal site, even if it's quote-unquote closed or no longer active, we do have requirements for ongoing monitoring. And so that's specific where we have identified a responsible party either for land disposal or for cleanup. And so they would be doing long-term monitoring. You'll actually be hearing later in the presentation on the regional monitoring program that we're relying on that to give us a broader receiving water monitoring approach. And so that's more looking at, when we're not specifically monitoring a site, what is it we're trying to protect and what is it we're accomplishing in that protection for broader waters.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for the presentation. It's informative and well done, as we always expect from the staff, and you always perform. We really appreciate it.
I would, since I don't think Meg is here yet to do the regional monitoring program presentation, I'd recommend we take hopefully what can be a short break, and then reconvene when Margaret is here and go into our action items.
Let's take a 10-minute break, and by then we'll try to figure out what our schedule is going to be for being able to get a quorum back and taking up the rest of the items.